And now, Beth Daly and Gloria Dickey.
All right, thanks, Bobby. So I'm just going to start off by introducing our three panelists for this panel on looking at the future of environmental journalism. To my far left, we have Ellen Gilmer for E&E News. She won third place in Outstanding Beat Reporting in a Large Market. Ellen is a legal reporter for EnergyWire, covering the oil and gas industry, renewables, and utilities. Her reporting focuses on the evolution of energy law in the face of the rapidly changing national energy landscape. She previously reported on state regulatory issues for EnergyWire and was copy editor for other E&E publications. Her work has appeared in the Oregonian, Scientific American, and NewYorkTimes.com. In the middle, we have Rachel Neuer. She won Large Market second place for Outstanding Beat Reporting. Her series, Illegal Wildlife Trade, featured stories about pangolins, slain sea turtles in Vietnam, and forgotten steps to save African wildlife, like protecting the rangers. Rachel is a freelance journalist who reports about science, travel, food, and adventure for outlets such as the New York Times, National Geographic, Scientific American, and more. She also writes two columns, Last Place on Earth and What If, for BBC Future. She's currently writing a book about the illegal wildlife trade set for publication with DeCapo Press for 2018. And here we have Navina Sadasivam, for Texas Observer. And she won first place in Outstanding Beat Reporting Small Market. Navina is a staff writer covering the environment, energy, and climate change at The Observer. Prior to joining them, she wrote about the coal industry for Inside Climate News and fracking for ProPublica. At ProPublica, she was part of a team that reported on the Water Woes of the West, a project that was a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting. She has a degree in chemical engineering and a master's in environmental and science reporting from New York University.
Great. So let's jump right in. Thank you all so much for being here. I look at your young faces and I say this is the future of environmental journalism in many ways. And so let's start with just give us your thoughts. And this is really, as you know, open-ended. Where do you see, from your own unique perspective, where environmental journalism is going, whether it's challenges, whether the good parts, the bad parts, and we'll launch it from there. And do you want to start?
Sure. So I think the future of environmental journalism is pretty similar to the past of environmental journalism, and in that there are all of these really important conversations we're having now about platforms and funding and challenges that matter, but at the end of the day, what matters most and what's going to make our work the most effective is just going back to those foundational skills of good, strong journalism, focusing on reporting that is aggressive, is careful, is fair, and digging into those people's stories, digging into documents, and telling those stories on whatever platform, you know, ends up working best.
Yep, Rich.
So I am a freelancer, so I can only speak to this from a freelancer's perspective. And I thought I would just keep my comments really practical and try to answer the question, can you make a viable career freelancing on the environment beat? The answer is yes. But you're going to have to hustle a lot, and you're going to have to be used to constant influxes of places coming and going. Change is always constant. For example, I'm sure many of you were also devastated when you heard 5 years ago that the New York Times was closing its environment desk. But I've been happy to find out that in the years since, the science desk has continued to accept freelance environment stories on a very regular basis. So that illustrates how these opportunities are constantly coming and going. Likewise, National Geographic, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, opened a new unit called Wildlife Watch that dealt exclusively with the illegal wildlife trade, which is pretty much my favorite thing to write about. However, a year into the project, they ran out of funding for freelancers, so now it's kind of hit or miss whether they can actually afford to pay me to write stories. So that's what I mean about just staying on top of the opportunities as they come and go and not being alarmed by change, because it will always be part of the job. Now, an additional component for me is I love to travel to report stories. I find the stories I report in the field to be much more rewarding in terms of what I find. I may go into a story with thinking I know the story, with a preconceived notion of it. I've got all the NGO talking points in my head, but once I get to the ground and talk to people, as I'm sure you're all aware, the story tends to take a different shape. So how do you actually pay to go to these places? Very seldomly have I found that someone will actually pay me to fly to like South Africa or Vietnam. I've gotten lucky a couple times. I've gotten a grant from SEJ to go to Myanmar. I've gotten a grant from the Pulitzer Fund for crisis reporting. And if you're not involved with that, I would suggest looking them up because they fund a ton of projects. So that's one way to get there. Other ways are, if you want to be a little bit more creative, I just got back from Kenya and Rwanda last week, and the BBC paid me and covered all the expenses to go there, but that was for a special section they were doing on underreported communities and how technology impacts their lives. So I found environment stories that still had a tech spin, and that allowed me to go report those environment stories and get those expenses covered. And sometimes I simply try to find environment stories to report while I'm on vacation. So I've reported for the New York Times from Mongolia and Siberia, and I was technically on vacation, but sometimes I can get an editor to pay for some of the expenses on the ground rather than the entire trip, or if nothing else, I can at least write those expenses off for taxes. And it, in the end, it enhances my vacation because I get to know the place better and I get to talk to interesting people that I wouldn't otherwise. Bottom line is, when you're reporting from the field, you really need to hustle, as I'm sure many people know. Try to do as many stories as possible. So when the Pulitzer Center sent me to South Africa and Malawi, I did a feature story on drones for The Times, a feature story for Newsweek about rhino horn trade, a news story for The Times about the CITES conference, and a Johannesburg travel guide for Delta Sky magazine. So yeah, that makes these stories be a little bit more, or these trips be more viable. So ultimately, it's just a balancing act. I don't think I could make a career solely reporting about the environment. I just don't think I would make enough. So I'm also taking assignments that I'm not as excited about in health and technology reporting, for example. It's interesting, but the environment is my passion. But those help me pay for the things I really want to do, which is environment. Finally, I'm aware that some of the things I've just described are only available to those who are privileged enough to cover some of those expenses themselves, and I'm concerned about how that might impact environmental reporting. I'm not sure what more can be done about it unless just more grants and opportunities are opened up. So yeah, that's my story. It's not been an ideal career path in many ways, but it's working for me so far.
Hi, Navina. So I wanted to just sort of step back and look at what's happened with environmental reporting in the last 10 years or so. Between 2008 and 2013, we saw a lot of layoffs. As Rachel mentioned, the New York Times disbanded its environmental desk. We saw CNN lay off a lot of its reporters. It was happening across the spectrum, really, at the national level and also at the local level. And that was partly, you know, a response to less ad revenue. We all know the story, right? More digital innovation. And in the years since, we have seen a comeback. We've seen the New York Times reinvest in climate change reporting. We've seen a lot of national outlets do that. And that's been really encouraging. But at the local level, I think that void has yet to be filled. In some ways, there are a lot of nonprofits that are coming up that seem to be filling that void. They're finding niches. There certainly is an appetite for environmental reporting. The readers want to read environmental stories. And so I think, you know, looking ahead, it's going to be really crucial for national outlets to be more plugged in at the local level, whether that's through partnerships, whether that's through some sort of innovative funding mechanism where maybe you have one reporter that's funded by three outlets and their stories are then cross-published across all of those platforms. I think that's something that we need to sort of reinvest in and to be thinking about. At The Observer, we've actually hired a rural reporter. He doesn't live in Austin, he lives out in Abilene, and he's born and raised Texan, and he really understands the community and those issues. And so he's been a great addition to the team, and a lot of the stories that he does tend to be environmental stories, because those are the stories that he seems to be finding out in Abilene. So I think that's something that we really need to be focusing on in the future is how do we make sure that we're adequately representing more rural communities in our reporting.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm wondering if you could each, Rachel touched on this a little bit, but if you could each tell us about some of the resources that went into the projects for which you won your SEJ awards, and you know, what resources were made available to you, and what ones did you seek out, and what were some of the challenges and or perhaps surprising sort of easiness to some of that reporting that you did?
So my reporting for that category was on tribal energy issues, which involved reporting on the Dakota Access protests, but also several other issues that are playing out with different tribes handling energy development in different ways. So one of the stories is about the Blackfeet Nation in Montana, which is concerned about nearby proposed oil and gas development on government-held lands that the tribe considers sacred. Another issue for a different story that I wrote about was the Ute Nation in Utah, which embraces oil and gas development and is very concerned that certain federal regulations from the Obama administration were going to hamper their efforts. So going into a story like DAPL, I think it was really helpful that I had already reported on the Utes and the Blackfeet Nation and plenty of other tribal issues. So those were really my resources, was having that background knowledge from these other tribes, seeking out advocates who advocate not just for environmental issues and not just for tribal issues, but who really are at the nexus of all of that. And so for all of those stories, I traveled, and I can thank my company for being enthusiastic about travel the way most reporters are. And I think the most challenging as far as resources was Dakota Access, because everybody was covering that story. There was a slew of information available, but wading through it and finding the best sources, because you don't just want somebody from industry saying X, somebody from the tribal community saying Y, and somebody from the environmental community saying Z. Like, you want the best people in each of those places. You want somebody who deeply understands the context of the issue, and finding those people and getting past, you know, maybe the louder voices who are pushing their talking points. You know, those things can be helpful, but they shouldn't drive the story. So it was a matter of just wading through all of those people to find the ones who really knew what was going on.
My second place series was on the illegal wildlife trade, and I just finished a book about the topic, so that's pretty much why I wrote. I mean, I love this topic, I write about it anyway, but all of these stories spun out of book reporting. I had basic sources already, because it's a story I've been reporting on for years. But a lot of the stories that I submitted for my entry involve voices on the ground, as I touched on earlier. So there's the story of a pangolin release in Vietnam. I'm in the forest with the people who are actually rehabilitating pangolins seized from the illegal wildlife trade and giving them a second chance at life. That's not something I could have just reported from a desk. Well, I suppose I could have, but it would have been a much lesser story. As far as resources, because this was for the book, when I signed my book contract, I kind of accepted that I would be pumping in a lot of my personal money from my savings account into the reporting. So I paid for the Chad trip, the Vietnam trip, and the Kenya trip out of my own account, which is unfortunate, but I figured was just a reality of writing this book. In the future, I would definitely not just pay for myself to go do one of these stories in Chad or something. So, something to think about.
I won first place for beat reporting, and I submitted 5 or 6 stories, I think, and some of them were sort of shorter pieces, and others were features. For the features, The Observer is a magazine first and foremost, and so the features are take a lot of time, months of reporting and research, and then months of writing and editing and so on. And so during the reporting process, The Observer does send me out wherever the story leads, essentially. As a staff writer, all my expenses are paid. I'm very fortunate that I have an editor who was also an environmental reporter before he became editor-in-chief, and so he really values these. I was into producing one of these stories, so I've been very lucky in that I get sent wherever the story takes me, and yeah.
That's great. I just want to go back into something we all touched on, and that's looking at the future. There's two questions I constantly think about is where will reporting take place and by whom? And I kind of want to break that down a little bit. And let's start, and you know, you talked a little bit about this, but let's talk about the where. Because journalism, as we all know, in many ways has become a bi-coastal profession. And many of us environmental journalists tend to be focused on the coast. But if you look at the landscape in the interior of the country, and something I've been passionate and thinking a lot about lately, is that the interior of the country has been hollowed out. I mean, there's no other word for it. By environmental journalism. There's some bright spots. The Arizona Republic just got a great grant from the Pulliam Foundation to do local reporting, which is amazing. And there are environment reporters, but it's not central to a news outlet's ethos as much as the crime or sports beat. So, like, how do we change that? Do we need to change journalists to convince them to go in the interior? Is it partnerships? I don't know anyone can take this first. You don't have to go in order, but...
I think to some extent it's up to us to be pitching those stories, and for those of us who are lucky to have newsrooms who will fund travel that we pitch, I think it's just a matter of identifying all of that that's been undercovered and pitching those stories and getting out there as much as we can. And I think, you know, there's something to be said about the fact that, like, for my stories, in this category, they were all from, you know, not the coasts. And for newsrooms that are, you know, in the center of the country, I think it's been heartening, actually, like you mentioned, the Arizona Republic, but also the Indianapolis Star. I'm from Indianapolis. They have two environmental reporters right now, and I think that's great for that newspaper. They have two people who are full-time just focusing on this issue. So hopefully more newsrooms will catch on to that, and hopefully we'll see more, you know, program-funded and grant-funded positions like that that are placing reporters in newsrooms to focus on those issues. And then those of us who are on the coasts, I'm in D.C., can just travel as much as possible.
I suppose for me, I tend to focus on places that are even more underreported in the center of our country, and that would be places like Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, those sort of places. I have not really covered issues in the center of the U.S., and I suppose I feel a little bit guilty about that. I'm not highly aware of those issues myself. As I said, I tend to gravitate toward these international stories, but were there grants available, that would be something I would look into. So yeah, for me, it would be a question of funding and just awareness of what the issues are. And having other journalists write about those issues would enhance that.
So the Texas media landscape is very fractured. The Dallas Morning News covers Dallas. The Austin American Statesman covers Austin. I think there are maybe two organizations, Texas Observer and the Texas Tribune, that are statewide. And between the two of us, there are maybe a handful of environmental reporters who cover these issues. So In some sense, it's a question of the business model and whether there's funding available for it. As a reporter, I do try my best to be plugged into communities that are outside of the cities to try to develop sources, try to find activists and environmental groups that are operating in more remote parts of the state. But it's a struggle, you know? When Hurricane Harvey hits, of course, all your attention is on Houston and you know, Harris County, and so sometimes things do get missed, and it's sort of, I think, on the reporter as well to try their best to sort of be looking for stories that don't fit a narrative that we've already heard. So.
And the second part of that is who are going to be telling those stories. Rachel, you mentioned, like, the fortunate ones who are able to, you know, freelancers can sometimes be a fortunate bunch are able to have either scramble really hard and don't make a living, or have some other potential, you know, ways to make money. But many of the communities that we cover, particularly in the environmental justice framework, are people, are places of color. And how do we get more journalists of color and of those reflecting the communities that they're reporting on? And I don't know how much of thinking about. It's really important to bring up.
So for me personally, I found that a strong editor, a strong editorial team that's supportive of the work that you do and is willing to take in your pitches and to prioritize them has helped quite a bit. I've written a couple of environmental justice stories for The Observer in my year and a half or so working there, and those pitches have always been well received. I think in some cases, even within the newsroom, there are difficulties in pitching those stories and making a case for them as to why they need to be reported out and why they deserve our time and attention. So that's one angle. In terms of how do we cultivate journalists of color, that's sort of an even broader question. It's an issue that's being, faced by a lot of newsrooms, not just in the environmental reporting community. And part of that is hire more people of color. Go find them, we're out there. you just need to be looking harder. And also for news organizations to invest in creating a pipeline for those journalists so that they can make it to a full-time staff writing position in turn that leads to more environmental justice coverage.
And I would just add that if you're an editor or you're in a position to hire people and your newsroom is posting job openings on, you know, journalism jobs or something like that, or just, you know, doing it through word of mouth, then you're missing a huge opportunity to be advertising openings on, you know, NABJ, NAJA, SAJA, all of these groups that are focused on people of color in journalism. They have outstanding journalists and great networks who can connect you to the right people who would be a good fit for the job.
And I would add that you can also reach beyond US journalists. I know Quartz, for example, has done a really excellent series where they partnered with journalists in Africa, and those stories to me were just fantastic. But it took them specifically seeking out that partnership.
Okay, thank you guys. We're about to switch over to Q&A for the remaining 30 minutes or so that we have. I have one more question for you. But first, can we invite members down to the microphone, just sort of right of center over there. Please identify yourself and your affiliation when you come up, and try and keep your questions pretty brief, no long speeches, so we're a little short on time here. And so my final question to you, I mean, a couple of you have mentioned funding. You know, that more and more things are being funded by foundations or nonprofit groups. How do you feel, I guess, about that as being the future, you know, the future of journalism at this point? Are there concerns about the stability or longevity of that kind of funding, or pressure from when you're accepting, you know, perhaps grants that are sponsored by nonprofit groups to go work on these stories? What do you think sort of the funding future of environmental journalism is?
So I don't work in a nonprofit newsroom, so we don't rely on that type of model. And so as a third party, you know, as a news consumer of those outlets that are funded, by grants and by organizations, the most important thing for me as the reader is transparency. I want to know where the funding is coming from. And so I can't speak to the future of that model, but I know that as a consumer of it, that's what I want.
I mean, I've had really good experiences working along that model, and I hope it sticks around for years to come because it's definitely a source of diversifying stories and allowing stories to be told that haven't been told. And as I said before, there's constant flux, so even if some of these sources fall away, hopefully new ones will rise up in their places.
Yeah, The Observer is a nonprofit, and our new development director is actually finding that there are a lot of foundations that are interested in making sure that environmental stories from Texas are reported and written about. And so I think, you know, what we've been doing so far has worked for us, and we're probably going to be continuing to do that.
Great. Thank you, guys. Questions, anyone? There's an empty microphone. I know you're all still eating lunch, but...
I do have a follow-up on
okay.
the fun,
oh, there
the
we
question,
because okay.
I now work for a nonprofit news, and I'm curious if you look towards the future, does it worry anyone that you see a lot of environmental news as being, and necessarily so, being funded by foundations and whatnot? And Do you see that as a sustainable model for the long term, or do you think, I'm curious, do you think that's just going to be something we're going to have to just accept and rely on, that there's no longer a business model out there?
I think that a mix of business models is the best path forward. And again, I don't know what the future of nonprofit journalism is, except that certainly there is a great, you know, a broad future for it. But there are other models that are working because people are willing to pay for, you know, well-reported stories, well-reported journalism. And so, you know, subscription models, you know, standard newspaper stuff also is still working in many contexts.
I agree that I think a mix is very healthy, and places like The Times, National Geographic, and numerous others still pay for these stories, so I think everything is looking up.
Yeah, I want to echo what both of them said, but also add that I think even if you do have a staff writing position, I think you're going to be, especially if you're working at a nonprofit, you're going to be working more closely with the business side and trying to keep them appraised of the stories that you're working on, future pitches that you see coming down the pipeline, so that you know, the business folks can then take those pitches to foundations and try to fundraise off of that.
Thank you. Still no audience questions? Oh, we got
I've
one.
I've got one. Not an SEJ member, but a speaker, and I appreciate the chance. I'm interested in the fact that it's Peter Kelly with the American Wind Energy Association, and I'm interested in the fact that some of your stories take you on the front lines of either literally a shooting war in the case of wildlife poaching, or maybe a culture war, in which you've got concerns for your personal safety, or maybe literally concerns for the safety of your sources, or perhaps you're just in very pitched adversarial environments. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how you navigate that.
Good question. Well, I was never in like a shootout with poachers and rangers or anything like that. When I did have the opportunity to interview poachers, I mean, that was one of the surprising revelations to me, that they're just kind of normal people-ish trying to make a living. And, you know, they're happy to sit down and have a chat and even share a beer. When I was reporting my book, I never felt threatened for my life or even really in a hostile situation, as counterintuitive as that might sound. Going somewhere like Chad, I mean, it was fine. We have these conceptions about places in our mind, but when we get there, it's usually completely different. I did have to go undercover to a really shady casino town on the Lao border run by a Chinese mafia man, and my editor for the New York Times told me if I do fear for my life, I should leave, because he doesn't want to have to explain why the Times was sending freelancers to their death. But nothing ever came of that. It never felt hostile or weird. It was just a strange place to report from.
I would just echo, yeah, what Rachel said about her, about the New York Times editors. Everybody has their own, should use their instincts in those situations, and everybody has a different level of comfort with risk. So you should discuss your level of comfort with risk with your editors before you go into a situation that might be hostile, and know at what point you're going to get out, and just have that agreed upon beforehand.
Yeah, I've never quite been in a situation where I was being shot at or anything like that, but in the office we have been talking quite a bit about protest coverage and how to make sure that our reporters are safe when they're out, you know, covering what seems to be just like a regular protest, and then before you know it, you know, maybe there are altercations. So we've talked a little bit about that, and we've talked about security training and sort of being prepared for those situations, and and sort of telling reporters that, listen, you don't have to be there. If you're feeling unsafe, get out. Like, we want you to come back to the office. You know, you don't should not feel obligated to say if you're feeling threatened.
Hi, my name is Antonia Yuhas. I'm a freelance journalist working on oil and energy from San Francisco, and thanks for the presentation so far. I was just trying to sort of continue that theme. I'm wondering if you can talk about, within the theme of the title of the panel, the future of environmental journalism, What are the things that worry you looking forward, and also the transition from this morning of working pre-Trump administration and now in Trump administration? What's made your work more difficult or easier, and looking forward? Thanks.
Something that worries me in general, and particularly this year, is that there are so many strong journalists out there. That doesn't worry me, that's great. But there are so many instances in which I see the line is blurred between journalism and advocacy, and I think that undermines what we're doing. I think that we're not adding value to the debate if we are just putting our snarky opinions on Twitter about whatever policy issue is out. So I think there is a strong temptation to do that, and maybe that's gotten stronger for some people. And to the extent people are able to resist that urge, I think that would help all of us. And it wouldn't, I think it can undermine the legitimacy of what environmental journalists are doing. And we shouldn't be, the environmental community has a very strong voice. The industry has a very strong voice. The administration has a strong voice. We don't need to amplify any one of them necessarily. What we need to do is be cutting through all of that and giving people all of the objective information in context and analysis, but without just like our random personal views on the day's news.
As a freelancer, I guess my biggest worry and concern is that suddenly it'll just all stop. Like, it might be going so well, and I have years of proof that it works, but maybe for whatever reason, everyone will stop taking freelance, and it'll just dry up. So far, it hasn't happened, fingers crossed. As far as Trump goes, that's definitely triggered existential concerns that reach far beyond just my job, but it's also made me all the more determined to do a good job at what I do.
Yeah, this is not specific to the Trump administration, but I think the deterioration of FOIA laws at the federal level and then state public information laws is really worrying. Another thing that I've been sort of dealing with in the last year, year and a half, is spokespeople who want to be on background, you know, sort of just mundane comments that you know, you would expect a spokesperson to make on a story. It's nothing controversial at all. And they'll still say, hey, can you quote me as you know, just a spokesperson? Don't name me in your story. And I'm thinking, wait, you're the press officer. If I say I spoke with someone and I'm working out of Texas and there's a Texas story, there's only one press officer in that agency. It's you. I mean, like, people are going to figure it out, so I don't get what you're achieving here. But anyway, so that kind of trend is really, really concerning, and I think that's becoming more and more the case.
Why do you think that is? I mean, what is it about? Is it a fear of being associated with something they may get called out on, or, yeah?
I think in some cases they found that reporters don't push back. So, you know, I sort of confronted this spokesperson and said, like, it doesn't make sense what you're saying. Why would you not want me to name you in the story? And so I think they've been able to get away with it. And so they suggested, and she immediately backed off and she said, oh yeah, okay, sure, yeah, use my name, okay. And so it was just that extra question or two that got her to sort of relent. And I think, you know, if they can avoid any scrutiny of any kind, it's to their advantage. I think maybe that's what's driving it.
I just had a quick follow-up off of that for Rachel. Another thing that sort of emerged is that a lot of U.S. publications are looking very inward in the year since Trump. As an international freelancer, do you find that that's something that concerns you, or a struggle to try and place stories when so many resources are going towards American stories now?
Right, definitely. So I just emerged from a book writing cave that lasted about a year, about a month ago, so I'm quite new back to freelancing. One of the first stories, though, I pitched the New York Times is a story about North Korea's involvement with rhino horn trafficking. And, you know, I was like bugging my editor, like, can you please get an answer? Can you please get an answer? And finally he got back to me, and this was last week, saying, okay, things are too tense right now. We have to do anything North Korea in-house. I'm not sure if rhino horn would tip us into nuclear war, but that was the reality. Luckily, National Geographic said they would take it immediately. So at least in that case, it worked out. And it's just, again, coming back to having multiple clients and always having a plan B, C, D. I don't know how it's going to work in the future, but one and one.
I'm Emily Gertz. I'm a freelancer from New York City. This is for Rachel, although others are welcome to answer as well if they have input. How are you, given the kind of complexity and the travel and the scope of the work you're doing as a freelancer, how are you handling indemnification with your clients?
I always try to negotiate my indemnification clause if it puts everything on me to at least say to the best of author's knowledge, I will not make things up. Was there something, are you talking about indemnification about me going and like risking my life or?
No, more like if you're dealing with subjects that, you know, in the current environment could be, attract legal challenges. You know, most contracts I've been seeing since I came back into freelancing this year have left all that up to the freelancer, and that really is a disincentive to take hard-hitting stories if you can't renegotiate that clause.
Yeah, I definitely agree. One of the stories that I'm on the stage for was about this huge sea turtle bust in Vietnam, and in the story you'll notice that I awkwardly say, like, the suspect or the man whose name we cannot name. So I know that guy's name, but the National Geographic lawyers took a look and decided that the illegal sea turtle trader, allegedly in Vietnam, maybe would sue National Geographic, so we couldn't use the alleged illegal sea turtle guy's name. So in some cases like that, I've got people's lawyers or outlets' lawyers looking at the stories. In other case, I suppose I'm just kind of accepting a degree of risk and hoping things work out.
So I'm Colin Schultz, an editor, coming at it from a slightly, yeah, I didn't really tell. This question is mostly for Rachel, but also for anyone really who has an insight to it. Putting aside the obvious answer, which is pay us more, what do you feel you're not able to do in your freelance career? And what can editors do to support that work, putting aside the obvious answer of pay us more?
Thanks, Colin. I like you too. Colin's a great editor. You guys should write for him. Really deep dive stories I kind of shy away from just because I know about the time it's going to take me to do them, and for me, time is absolutely money. So I just went to a panel about getting PIOs to talk to you and doing FOIAs, and I really want to do that, but it's something that I just haven't done yet because it intimidates me and thinks this is going to be a giant black hole of time and it's never going to be able to pay for itself. So for me, that would have to be a passion project rather than something that makes money, and yeah, it's just, it's not realistic unless it was really something special.
To sort of offload some of the work or partner dual byline things? Like, is, I guess, so if budgets are fixed, like if we're assuming that budgets are fixed, what sort of support would you be looking for to enable you to do the part of the project that you're best at? What parts would you kind of shirk off if possible?
I mean, yeah, if I could work with a researcher or another journalist who's got a full-time staff job and can do that for me, definitely that would help. Higher word rates would make the case, or an hourly rate. I haven't really encountered anyone who does an hourly rate, but that could be something that could potentially enable it.
I just got a question for Ellen. So, and maybe this is the positive part of looking forward, right? It's like you work for a publication that people pay to access, right? And where do you see that going? Do you think more people, as environmental journalism becomes maybe potentially more, could it become more niche-based and you could have that sort of pay model, or do you not see that happening because it's too, love your thoughts.
For environmental policy journalism, there's definitely room in that space for growth. People are willing to pay top dollar for policy news, political news, legal news, industry news. For broader environmental journalism, I'm not sure what people are willing to pay. People are willing to pay, but I don't know that they're, I don't know where those limits are and where those growth limits are. But when you're reporting in depth on technical issues, wonky issues, but you're bringing them into context and telling this bigger story, talking to experts and real people and all of that, people will pay a lot. And I think DC is a great example. There are like at least a handful of newsrooms, of well-staffed newsrooms, that are just completely focused on environmental policy, which is so specific. And you know, we are aggressive, we compete with each other, there's no shortage of stories to be told, and I think there's definitely a market for that.
Do you have anything, Gloria?
I think that's it. We've got one more at the mic, and then I think we're gonna wrap things up.
Hi, I'm Arielle Breen with the Gaylord Herald Times in Northern Michigan. I was curious, maybe this is more for Ellen, but you were talking about weeding through some of those voices. How do you kind of do that? What is your process of finding those key voices in the research part?
I talk to a lot of lawyers, which might be not an answer a lot of people would be excited about. But I do talk to a lot of lawyers because they typically know. So I cover legal issues, so obviously I talk to lawyers, but even in non-legal stories, there are typically lawyers involved, and they tend to know all of the players. So whenever I talk to anybody, I say, who else should I talk to? And they tell me who else I should talk to. And sometimes those people are a dead end, and sometimes I stumble upon a great source who I then return to again and again to get, you know, the inside scoop on something. So it's just, I think that is a great starting point. It's just asking everyone you talk to, who's the go-to person on this issue? Because it might not be the person who's on all the press releases, and it might not be the loudest person on Twitter. It might be, you know, this wonky, low-key person who isn't, you know, amplifying their kind of personal persona.
All right, thank you so much to all three of our panelists who joined us here today to discuss the future of environmental journalism sort of through their eyes. So nice to have three young female journalists, kind of a little bit of a change from some previous panels and sort of how you're making it work within your respective career paths. So please give a warm round of applause for our panelists.